Hello, my name's Lottie Whittingham.
Hi.
And we're here at the Freud Museum with the author William Rose to discuss his book, The Strange Case of Madeleine Sagan. Hi, William. Could you tell us a little bit about the book to start with?
Okay, well, the novel is set in Paris. Mainly, it does sort of end up somewhere else right at the end, but it's set in Paris in 1885 and 86 in the main. It's a time, I suppose, a sort of heyday of Charcot, Professor Charcot of the Salpêtrière Hospital, it's sort of relevant to where we are at the moment, the Freud Museum. I could say that I was interested in sort of getting Freud in there just a bit. He's actually not a character in the novel, though he's sort of referred to. He's kind of around as some sort of presence, really, I suppose, throughout. Autumn 1885... early 1886 were the times when he was studying with Charcot. And so I thought, well, I will have the novel taking place mainly at that time, really because he just happened to be there. But it sort of suited, you know, the way it is sometimes with these things. I found that it kind of fell into place with other things that I wanted to bring into the novel as well. Other themes, they sort of match that date. So so it's set then. It's in Paris, the Salpêtrière Hospital. Which, of course, is, you know, the sort of centre of the work, the researches, Charcot's researches with hysteria. The Salpêtrière Hospital is the sort of main base of the story, I guess, really. It's not all set within the hospital, but somehow it all sort of emanates from there. And the chapel there, which is important, which is part of the hospital. And all around there was a culture that I was interested in. And Madeleine Sagan is the central character, and she is a patient, and as Charcot seems to have had, a sort of one of his favourites, or certainly one who a lot of attention is given to, and as part of the public lectures, for instance. And she is left, strange case, at the gates of the hospital as a... I think, if I remember rightly, a late teenager, by an aunt, apparently somebody who says she's an aunt, takes her in there and sort of leaves her there, really abandons her, and she's what they would certainly have accepted to be a hysteric of the major kind. She has a range of symptoms that I think actually in the early years they get a bit worse actually, but then do get better. So she's suffering from the, you know, various things like paralysis, and she's mute. She doesn't say anything for a very long time. And when she does start to speak, it's in English rather than French, and they can't work that out, but Charcot is quite sure that that is a hysterical symptom, along with the others. And then around her sort of circulate all these characters. I mean, Charcot himself, there's a young doctor working there who I sort of kind of rather liken to Freud, actually. He becomes a psychoanalyst later on. There's an artist who is working in Charcot's house. Charcot had this wonderful mansion by that time. And he commissioned this artist to do the paintings in the summer house of his garden there on Shakespearean themes, because Charcot did like Shakespeare. So that's sort of fitted, and this young artist becomes part of the story too. He's a symbolist artist. And there's a priest who works in the chapel of the Salpêtrière, who has a major part too. And then there are one or two other artists. I try to bring in people from the culture of the time, like Stéphane Mallarmé, the writer, and Huysmans, and also a fictional character, the Countess de Beauvoir, who I sort of invented, really. And she provides the edge, if you like, and the danger. So it's Madeleine's story, and does she manage to survive their attentions? Well, that's what the story is about. It's quite a challenge for her.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the Salpêtrière as an institution.
Yeah.
I know that it's had various incarnations over its life, and in the beginning of the novel we're introduced to the concept of the Salpêtrière as a sort of a warehouse for society's undesirables.
Yes.
And a kind of a prison.
Yes.
And then later on it became more of a sort of hospital. In your eyes, was the Salpêtrière, for the most part of your novel, a sort of harmful institution that was locking people up and keeping them away from society? Or was it more of a sort of haven to protect them from the rest of the world?
Well, I think probably neither. I didn't see it as harmful, because the novel does actually start off. The first chapter is in the French Revolution, but that's just a sort of prequel, really. Because there was some terrible events that occurred. September massacres, they were called. I think it was before the guillotining really started, but it was terribly violent, and a mob descended on the Salpêtrière. There's different accounts of quite what they were trying to do. And one account says they wanted to free the prostitutes. There's other accounts that say that they had some idea that there were enemies of the revolution in there. At any rate, they pulled people out and had these kangaroo courts. And I think it was over 30 women were executed, murdered, butchered, actually. I wanted that there, really, because it sort of sets a scene of malevolence which sort of returns later in the novel, and which the priest of the Salpêtrière is particularly concerned about, though the novel is set 100 years or so later in the main. At that time, Louis the 14th decided that he wanted his Paris to be a place of beauty, and he didn't want all the flotsam and jetsam hanging around the streets, particularly the prostitutes or the mad people or anybody who might sort of disfigure the scene, really. So he had the Salpêtrière converted into a place where they could be interred, and the mad people. And so certainly at that time it was an awful place. And people suffered terribly, particularly the mad ones who were just chained to the walls. And it was Pinel, particularly, who is known to have come along later and freed them unchained them from the walls. And but by the time Ashako gets there, it's a proper hospital. And it has psychiatric patients, the mad, the epileptic, people suffering from various nervous disorders, and this large proportion of people who were termed hysterics. And I think there were very few doctors in proportion to the patients, but nevertheless, I wouldn't see it as a prison for them. I think it was, and clearly some of them, many of them, were people who were suffering very greatly. So there was some provision being made.
Yes.
And there was scientific investigation being made by Sharko and his team as to particularly, well, with various groups of them, you know, what ailed them.
And the young doctor that you mentioned who was a bit like Freud.
Yes. Yeah.
Lamond.
Yes.
In a letter to Freud that he writes partway through the book, he says that there is an unconscious, a veritable salpetriere of the psyche, which harbours ideas and emotional ventures we can scarce dare even think of.
Yes.
Would you be able to expand a little bit more on that for me?
Yes. I think to start off with that, it's best if I start off with Sharko himself, because,
yes.
And thinking about Sharko in relation to the unconscious, there's this sort of strange thing that Sharko seems to have been, was such a pioneer in working towards the psychogenic causes of illnesses of that kind of hysterical disorder. The non-physical causes, and yet he could never quite sort of go all the way on that. So though he, on the one hand, he seemed to be demonstrating that these difficulties that hysterics suffered could be to do with trauma, you know, and sort of terrible ideas of things. On the one hand, he was doing that, but on the other, he was always looking for an anatomical cause, a lesion, because he was a neurologist, and he somehow never freed himself from that, and Freud, I think, knew that he didn't. But, of course, the work that he did, Sharko did, set Freud on his path to really freeing their investigations from the physiological onto the psychological and the unconscious. So this letter that you've mentioned from the young young neurologist who does become a psychoanalyst later on to Freud is because, if I'm remembering rightly about it, it's he, working with Sharko, is himself discovering the unconscious and starting to realise about unconscious causes for these disorders, and he's wants to write to Freud about it. I think that's what that was about.
Is it that Lamond's sort of breaking away from Charcot's clinical anatomical, very sort of pathological work as a neurologist, and moving more towards a kind of psychoanalytical way of viewing things?
Yes, as indeed part of Charcot was.
I got the impression from reading around the subject a little that Sharko was never really happy with the work that he produced on hysteria because he wasn't able to find a physical lesion.
I think that is true. Yes.
The next thing that I wanted to sort of mention as another main theme that's in your novel that we haven't really talked about yet is the church.
Yeah.
And the church and religion are described in the novel throughout as a kind of theatre. And there's various parallels drawn between the church and a sort of hysteria and the hysterical demonstrations that Sharko would do in the Salpêtrière. And I know that you've mentioned that the occult was sort of gradually mm-hmm. creeping in to replace religion mm-hmm. at this mm-hmm. kind of fin de siècle era. What do you think it was about the Catholic Church at this particular time mm-hmm. that was encouraging sort of comparisons to hysteria and lapses into the occult?
Right. Well, I think that the influence of the Catholic Church was waning, the science was gaining ascendancy. And Charcot and Bonneville, who he worked with, very important colleague of his, and Bonneville was particularly anti-clerical. Charcot, who was also a society figure, I think treaded very carefully in this respect. And I believe Madame Charcot did take the children to church in a sort of fairly regular way. But one gets the impression, reading between the lines, that Charcot was not a religious man. And science is what was important to him.
Yeah.
So there was a sort of science-religion conflict going on at the time. As to the thing about the church being theatre and sort of linking it to hysteria, I think that would be to do with Charcot's researches really into the past and into the Catholic saints and particularly the ones who had had this massive mystical revelations he saw that that some of them were hysterics, in fact, you know, that this sort of possession of the spirit that they experienced and sometimes meant that they were revered was in fact them exhibiting symptoms of hysteria, possession.
Mm,
yeah.
The hysterical demonstrations that Charcot
yes.
and Salpêtrière were playing in a way on a sort of fin de siècle fascination with all this kind of the occult and things
yes.
like seances and Satanism.
Yes.
But I'm not sure to what extent the role religion had in the lives of the hysterics at the Salpêtrière.
Well, I think only in so far as I think for a lot of them, not very much, but for some of them, for some of those so-called hysterics, in their fantasies and their hallucinations, religion would play a part. There is, I think it might have been Augustine who for hours went into a contracture in which she was as if on the cross.
Mm. Yes.
Actually, I do have Madeleine in the novel do something similar to that as well. So she was like that for hours, and then when she came round back into consciousness, she said it had been absolutely wonderful. So I think one might say that for these that kind of hysterical experience to be taken over by religious ecstasy or terror played a part.
Mm.
It was a way of expressing elements of their unconscious, actually.
Yes. I suppose for Augustine in particular, the religious element is pertinent because she was raised in a convent.
Right.
And so a lot of her symptoms were related to religion and to religion.
Well, thank you, Augustine, than I do, actually. Or that I remember, at any rate. So. So that would certainly figure, yes, wouldn't it?
While we're speaking of particular hysterics at the Salpêtrière, were there any particular characters that you based Madeleine on?
Not a particular one. There is the famous Blanche, also known as Wit, who is in the famous painting, the engraving of which Freud had forever in his consulting room, and which is followed here to Maresfield Gardens,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes, the Breuer painting that's above the consulting couch.
Exactly. Yes. And there she is, sort of fallen back into the, can't remember who it was now, the assistant's arms, and Charcot is there, sort of demonstrating and talking about it. So Blanche was also known as the Queen of the Hysterics, and that just gives some idea of the roles that some of these women started to play in popular culture of the time. Mm. She was generally known as the Queen of the Hysterics. I think that famous painting, the etching of which is in the consulting room, would have been one of the Tuesday clinic sessions, mm-hmm. Because he did these clinical sessions to which colleagues mainly were invited. These were smaller affairs in the hospital, and I suspect that is one of those, because it looks quite small, really, whereas the public lectures, which were on Fridays, were, you know, big events,
yes,
and in a lecture theatre. So, yeah. So it was just Madeleine. I was very interested in the exhibitionism of it all, actually. And of course, Freud became very interested in exhibitionism and voyeurism too, later on, as sexual components. But I mean, there was terrific exhibitionism and voyeurism going on, and these female hysteric celebs, if you like, were sort of the unwitting, well, Charcot was the star, but they were the co-stars in a way.
And seeing as we're talking about the Friday lectures and the demonstrations, do you think that the hysterics and hysteria was part of the public consciousness at the time, or was it more reserved just for the intelligentsia that came to the lectures? Do you think the average person would have known about hysteria?
Well, things do permeate out, don't they, in various ways. They get into the culture, even if it's not in a in a very conscious way. But it was really the intelligentsia, mm-hmm. and the cultured who knew about this. But for them, it was a very powerful a sequence of events that was going on at these lectures. And they were extremely popular. The lecture hall could take up to 400 people, and it would be packed. And I suspect it was nearly all men that were there. In fact, I think in the novel I describe it as a sort of sea of black and white coats and beards, mm-hmm. really. Mm-hmm. And probably a lot of cigar smoke as well, because
yes,
it was a real major event. Mm-hmm. And and Charcot would come in with his cohorts, quite a procession. Everybody would rise for the great man, and then the demonstration would begin. And of course, it wasn't always just about hysterics, but that's, of course, became my focal point because of what I wanted to write about, and certainly for the public at large. I think it was his demonstrations with hysterics, especially where he used hypnotism, that was the fascination. So as to hysteria, sort of in the culture, public culture at large, I expect some of it permeated through, but I think what really permeated through most of all was a culture around hypnotism. And that was kind of more accessible for people, really. Hysteria still was this kind of medical thing,
yes.
Even though it's strange and fascinating and overlaps with even with the occult. Hypnotism could be demonstrated, in the local theatre down the road.
Yes.
And was. And at parties and so forth. So I think, and also you can't, when I think about this, really, you can't, when you're thinking about Charcot and hysteria, you can't really separate out hypnotism from it. They're sort of wedded together. For him, hypnotism was the evidence that somebody was a hysteric. If you could hypnotize them, they were a hysteric.
Yes.
And though it was disagreed with later, if you couldn't hypnotize them, they weren't a hysteric. Mm. Hypnotism was his way of research, but also his way of demonstration, because he through suggestion, he could bring about hysteric symptoms in front of an audience and demonstrate them. So I think hypnotism really was as much as anything, the part of it that got into popular culture. And also, as you may know, there were, I think I'd refer to one in the novel, that there were some defences in court by people accused of murder. I think at least one murder case in which the person accused said, well, I was hypnotized. Mm. So it was right in the culture, getting into it in all sorts of ways.
Yes. Mm. And these demonstrations functioned in the novel often as a way of introducing Madeline to the various other characters. And I know that the artist in particular saw her at one of the demonstrations and became quite fascinated with her. Mm. And hysteria sort of often tended to be the women who had quite a heightened sexuality and sort of a delirious excess and were often very exaggeratedly feminine. Were these the characteristics in particular that made Madeline so appealing as a kind of a muse for the artist? Or what was it about her in particular that made her appealing towards the artist?
His projections, I think, really. Actually, Madeline is not a very sexual character. I don't think.
No, I didn't get the impression.
Without saying, giving the story away, neither is she without sexuality. I saw that as, this is an artist. It's near the beginning of the novel. Because he's working for Charcot and doing the murals for him, Charcot says, come along to one of my lectures, and you can even do a few drawings, which of course he would like. The artist, Louis, goes along to one of the lectures. I think it's maybe the second or third chapter. Third chapter, I think. And he then writes to his friend, because all of this is epistolary, isn't it? The whole novel is about letters and case reports. That's the way it's done. He writes to his friend and says, oh, I've just seen the most wonderful thing. And he's fallen in love with Madeline, but Madeline really had very little to do with that. She was the subject. I mean, she, in Jungian terms, I think, you know, she just becomes a complete anima figure for him. And he absolutely falls for it and becomes obsessed with her. And she is, you know, she's pretty. And but also, yes, I suppose there's something, you know, about hysteria and fainting and then being manipulated by the father figure on the stage and all of this, which sort of makes for submissive female. And if she looks nice as well, and she's got all this aura of terrific mystery about her because she's a hysteric and nobody knows, you know, where she came from, really. It sort of builds on the fascination. So he becomes fascinated. And then, of course, he has this sort of fantasy that she looks at him as she leaves the stage. And I think that is a fantasy, actually.
Yeah.
But anyway, he and then Charco later entrusts him with a friendship with Madeline. So he gets even... he pursues her even more. The other person who sees her on stage is the young doctor.
Lamont. Yes.
And who has a different take on it. For him, he sees Charco producing all of these hysterical symptoms in her, or demonstrating them on the stage, and then we know that, you know, when she leaves the stage, she is relieved of these symptoms by hypnosis. And Lamont thinks, well, here is the evidence, you know, that it can't be a physiological thing, because if you can bring it on with hypnosis or take it away with hypnosis, it's to do with the mind. And so for him, seeing Madeline on stage like that at the theatre of the Sarpetria, that's what fascinated him as a doctor and a scientist.
Was that one of the key moments that pushed him towards a more Freudian, as it were, view of hysteria rather than Charcot's anatomical view?
Absolutely, yes.
And it seems that there are a couple of other characters that become quite entranced with Madeline as well. The priest and also Charcot himself seem to have a kind of a fascination with Madeline. Would you say that's right?
That's right, yes. Yeah. I mean, it was one of the points of the novel. In case, again, I have to be a bit careful about, I don't want to give away too much, but but the degree to which somebody in Madeline's position is the recipient of projections is an important part of the story.
So Madeline, because of the effect that she had on the young artist, became a sort of muse for his art. And I know that the young artist in the novel was one of the first symbolist artists. Do you think there was something particular about symbolist art that made Madeline a particularly appropriate muse?
Yes. And symbolism as a movement is a very important part of the novel too, and which is why I had the artist, one of the reasons I had the artist in there, because through him we meet other symbolists too, including the writers Mallarmé and Huysmans. The symbolists what they were interested in was suggestion, not concrete imagery, but the painting and drawing of dream and the inner world, really. It's quite useful to to compare them with the Impressionists because they're around the same time, and the Impressionists are very, very much looking outwards and thinking, how can I best describe this scene, the landscape nearly always, isn't it? And the external world, and doing it fantastically as well. Very well. Fantastic probably belongs more with the symbolists, because mm-hmm. they were concerned with the inner vision. Of course, obviously they describe it in terms of in figurative ways,
yes.
But it is their imaginings on the whole that they were painting. So hysteria sort of really fits for them, because it's to do with the unknown, it's to do with strangeness, it's to do with sort of inner workings that are a mystery, really. Mm. So they were interested in that, and of course, out of studying hysteria comes a study of dreams as well. 1900, exactly, Fantasy Eckler Freud comes out with The Interpretation of Dreams. It's all sort of... I was just fascinated by the way these things overlap, really, and link together these different elements in the culture. The symbolists, yeah, I think that's it, really. Mm.
And to expand on that a little bit more, Huysmans is a character within the novel, and he features at the meetings of the Mahdists on Tuesday evenings.
Yeah.
And when he's talking about decadence and a decadent character that he's written about at one point, he says that he must undoubtedly decay in neurasthenic self-absorption.
Yes, yeah.
In what ways are the decadents and the symbolists similar to the hysterics? And is that neurasthenia distinct from a kind of hysteria, or is it along a similar vein?
Yeah, I think it's really... interesting question, actually. I think that neurasthenia was the sort of the kind of polite way of being neurotic.
Yes.
Whereas the sort of the hysterics, well, obviously could be much more extreme in their disturbance, but nevertheless, it comes to be thought of as a neurosis. It's not a psychosis. And neurasthenia was a neurosis too, but it almost seems like it's the privilege of the intelligentsia, the artists, the refined. It's the refined neurosis. So, you become self-obsessed and inward, and turn away from the outside world. Some of them, decided the outside world was a disgusting thing. They were really sort of in trouble, really. Mm. But there was a refinement of the senses. That was the thing. But it all became quite a neurotic thing. And so they would then suffer, sort of malaise and, I suspect, depression. Huysmans' character in the remarkable book Araboa, Against Nature, which is the symbolist book, novel, really, his character in that, Des Esseintes, is such a person. And his hobby was sort of refining wonderful perfumes and things like that, and so forth, and being in ecstasy about symbolist artists and writers.
So not just because of the artists, but also because of Charcot himself, the idea of the visual is quite a strong theme throughout the novel. And Charcot was described by Freud, I think, as a visuel, someone who did a lot of his work by looking at things.
Yes.
And then you also speak of a theatre and as describe him as the ringleader of a sort of hysterical circus. But at one point, you described during one of the Friday shows that the audience themselves are mesmerised. And I wonder if you think Charcot's spectacles were sort of solely a showcase for Charcot to show off and be admired and kind of be the ringleader of the circus, or if they were sort of therapeutic in a sense to the kind of neurasthenic intelligentsia that attended the lectures.
I suspect it fed the neurasthenia more than anything else, actually. Because of a sort of preoccupation with this and just observing, it's voyeuristic. There were serious scientists there, of course, as well. Some who came to learn and some who came to criticise. But I think there was a lot of sensation seekers there too. Just to say, it is a novel and one kind of tends to push one's characters in certain areas to suit the story, really. Charcot as the Napoleon of the neurosis, as he was often called, and the great showman, which he absolutely was, does not detract from the fact that he was one of the most esteemed scientists of his generation.
And
is still, has that reputation as a very important person in that way. So, but he was charismatic, and you mentioned the visual. He loved the visual. So I think that does get into the demonstration of things in the Salpêtrière lecture theatre and the clinic, the Tuesday clinics too. The way he worked was visual. He was a tremendous observer, as was Freud. So his ability to describe, to notice symptoms and describe them by observing a patient visually was apparently remarkable. And then added to that, they drew them. And he and Richet, who was his assistant, who was an artist as well, they did many, many drawings. And there's also the case that as to Charcot and visualization, there was a choice he made early in life about whether to be an artist or whether to follow a medical career.
Yes.
He had talent and it was known. And I believe he even had the opportunity to pursue art. I don't think it was forbidden to him, but anyway, he chose the other path. But art was always there for him.
Yeah. You refer in the novel to his artworks and his wife's artworks around his house. The other thing I wanted to point out that links Charcot and Freud in terms of their interests was literature, and Shakespeare in particular. As you mentioned, the murals were based on the works of Shakespeare. Do you think there's a particular link between loving literature and wanting to be a psychiatrist or a neurologist?
It's not one that I'd thought of.
Seems to link Charcot and Freud, but perhaps it's...
Maybe. Yes, Freud was very keen too, wasn't he, on Shakespeare? Well, I suppose it's character, isn't it? It's the ability of the writer to bring out character and delve underneath the surface. So I suppose that would certainly be an attraction for both of them.
A recurring theme in the novel is the femme fatale.
Yes.
And the idea of the femme fatale.
Yes.
Could you explain a little bit about the role of the femme fatale in the fin de siècle, in the context of the novel?
Absolutely. Of course, I do have such a one in the story. Well, I think I sort of tend to think of the Salpetri as being this sort of kind of a hub of sort of compressed femaleness, you know,
yeah,
under pressure, yeah. And full of women who have been under pressure. If we do think about certainly a lot of the cases as being about repressed sexuality, because repressed, forgotten sexual abuse, trauma, sexuality does play a major part in it. And I sort of see this kind of emanating out from Salpetri, really, through the portal of Charcot's lectures. And there he's got these women sort of fainting in, symbolic orgasm, actually, sometimes. So, the female sexuality was very, if not overtly evident, it was, it was being expressed, perhaps in distorted ways, but nevertheless it was impressing itself. And within the psyche of the male symbolist artists, who were the ones really dealing with the inner world at the time, femininity was rising up. And if it wasn't inspiring them, it was sort of terrifying them, really. And there is the femme fatale, because, you know, she is both tremendously attractive and also tremendously frightening. And I think a lot of the male symbolist artists portray a pretty strong castration anxiety. And it's, I don't think it's so much from the father, it's from the mother. It's from the feminine, that they fear the power of female sexuality, but they're fascinated by it. And we're in this process, beginning with Charcot's work and very much taken up by Freud, which was about, you know, trying to free that sexuality from oppression and repression.
And as you've said, a lot of the hysterics who were in the Salpetri, the root cause of their illness was deemed to be a kind of a repressed sexuality, or in some cases a kind of overt sexuality. And often women who are outside of the kind of Victorian ideal of, of the sort of angel in the house, as it were, the kind of perfect, desirable but undesiring woman, they're often labelled as being either a mad woman or a femme fatale, as you said. To what extent do you think that the women who were residents of the Salpetri were in fact mentally ill, or were they... Was it more a case that they were simply outside of the norms accepted at the time in society?
Well, I dare say that there were quite a number in the way that you describe, and we're going to know this as a kind of Victorian phenomenon, don't we, really? That, you know, the daughter who doesn't behave, or the wife who doesn't behave, you know, you're mad. You're mad. Let's go and see the doctor. And then, of course, you feed that. You know, you can send somebody mad or hysterical and put them away in an institution. Yes, so I dare say there was a lot of that happening. But there was also a lot of illness too. But Charcot came to increasingly be interested in trauma, even though he's still looking for a lesion in the neural system. But he became increasingly interested in trauma, and always they thought sexual. I mean, a lot of the time, at any rate, they thought there's something sexual in this. You know, something about the patient's past that is sexual, and connecting that up to trauma and so forth. I'm sure a lot of these patients who were hysterics were deeply traumatized people.
And Augustine, as we mentioned earlier,
had a
history of sexual abuse.
Yes.
And you hint that the cause of Madeline's hysteria might be related to a traumatic incident in the past.
Yes, I hint.
That's quite a Freudian view of the cause of hysteria and moving away from the kind of ideas of Charcot. Well, I suppose he came to think that towards the end.
Oh, he did come to think that in the end, yes.
Did your views on what might be the cause of hysteria change as you were researching the novel and reading about the ideas of the time?
There is a lot of questioning now, I think, isn't there, about these cases and incorrect diagnoses and so forth. And Charcot's sort of separated hysteria out from epilepsy. Because often the two were sort of mixed in together. And I believe he rather successfully, scientifically, did that. Now, I think it's sometimes argued that some of those hysteric patients were, in fact, epileptic. And that's what their symptoms were. And hysteria as a diagnosis is out of favour.
Yes.
It's not used very so much now.
Mm.
I sort of rather like to, one can sort of get rid of some of the things that were thought about it. But I think there's an essence in there that they were building and that Freud took on and built on, which... Mm. It still has its value, and I've certainly seen cases of hysteria.
One thing I wanted to talk about finally was the idea of power and the relationships of power within the book. And in the Femmes de Siècle, women were often solely defined by their relationships to men. Why did you decide to have Madeline as a predominantly silent character with her tale told mainly through a man's eyes?
I think to prove your point, actually. Mm.
So it was more of a sort of emphasis of women's position in society rather than because of her character.
Yes, And the fact that so much of what we see of her is through other people writing about her.
Mm.
The case reports, the letters, the so forth, so it's these male projections. So there is the Countess of Beauvoir, who's got her own thing going, but actually she doesn't project so much. She's after something else.
Mm.
I think the power imbalance is very evident in the novel and was very much in my mind, and I hope, and I can't say what happens in the novel here, but I hope that it might be clear that my wish for some resolution of that imbalance, it does become evident in the story.
Could you say a little bit about the instinct to possess and its role in your novel?
Oh, yes. it came about because I was asked to share a talk and at an event, psychotherapy organisation, the woman who kindly asked me to share with her thought we might do something. We might use Lord of the Rings as a basis for this, but take our own particular thing out of it.
Mm.
And she chose hers. And I was sort of rather interested at the time in the possessiveness that exists in human relations.
Mm.
And so I thought, well, here's a great opportunity because Lord of the Rings is so much about possession. It's this ring that people want to possess terror is an inanimate thing, but and then possesses you because you want to possess it so much. But I thought this is a quality also, if we go right into the most primitive areas of the psyche, you know, it's there. You know, we do not easily allow somebody to be their own absolutely separate person if they're close to us. You know, so of course this varies according to the individual. So and then I started to write this story, and I thought, well, yeah, that's it. I thought it would be a very good thing to try and write a sort of theoretical paper about, and yet I didn't really want to do that. And I thought it would be much better, I would enjoy myself much more if I made it the subject matter of a novel, and then I could, you know, just sort of imagine things around it and so forth. And so it is these characters, particularly these men circulating around Madeleine, who have a very possessive attitude towards her. So that's how it got into the... that's how I managed to get into the novel and sort of explore it a bit more.
And it struck me that Charcot in particular seemed fairly possessive of Madeleine in the way that he wanted to have control over her when displaying her to in his Friday demonstrations, and hypnosis in a way and is sort of possession of someone.
It's all part of the dynamics that were going on, I think. Charcot, I'm sure his discoveries of science, the outcome of his work with patients, was absolutely the most important thing for him. But it's just inherent in this, having a young woman as a subject on a stage and hypnotizing her and her being unconscious in that way. I mean, the power is very much, the word possession is part of the thing, isn't it?
Yes.
Of occult experiences and hypnosis, you know. Black magic and so forth, people get possessed. So.
Yes. And I just had one final question. We touched on it when we were speaking a moment ago, but do you think that hysteria is still relevant in our modern day society?
Yeah, I do, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting ways of observing it is in groups. The doctor in the... in the book describes a group hysteria. And he has a way of describing it, which is that it's like if you imagine all the reeds along by the side of a lake, and if a wind blows, the way it sort of gradually blows through them, and in turn each one is sort of bent over by the wind. And this is like a hysterical current that runs through people in group circumstances where everybody gets taken up by a particular emotion, often with a hypnotic character doing the conducting.
I'm reminded particularly of the first chapter and the description of the September Massacre in there.
That is one. That's such an example.
I think that's everything I'd like to ask you. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, thank you, Lottie,
thank you very much for
asking the questions. And it's been interesting to think about these things. Thanks.
And thank you for your excellent book.
Thank you. Thank you.